Hello, I am Tim Burrows. This is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production by Narelle, a unique digital agency. Narelle specializes in content production in the areas that matter most to your content strategy across podcast production, video production, and social media. If you want to increase your conversion or grow your brand trust, head to narelle.com to request a callback. That's NERALLE.com.
My name is Jordan Michaelides, and I'm the host of Uncommon, a show that asks the why on business, media, current affairs, and sport. If you like this episode, do leave us a written review on your podcast app, particularly if you're on Apple Podcasts, as it does help the feed work out. If you like this sort of content, to find all previous guests, just head to narelle.com/uncommon. For the full video, you can search Uncommon Show on YouTube. For social, you can keep up to date with behind the scenes at uncommon_show on Instagram. But with all that being said, let's get into the episode. My guest this week is co-founder, and editor at large of Mumbrella, Tim Burrows, who I was mentioning before, and we've spoken about now that we are disrupting from his long service leave and the book writing. I was looking at icebreakers to begin, but I've got to ask, being that my fiance's mother's side of the family is from Tasmania, let's say they're fairly split between Launceston and Hobart, why Sisters Beach?
Well, shout out for the north of the island, first of all. So I feel I'm instinctively drawn to the Launceston side of the the clan. But yeah, look, you know, my partner has some family connections to the sort of north and northwest of Tasmania. So that's part of it. And some of it as well was when it came time to find a place away from Sydney that was on a beach, then Tasmania is quite affordable with New South Wales. So slightly less warm, perhaps. But yeah, that's definitely a factor as well.
Tasmania, for a lot of people on the mainland, I feel, is undertapped. It is a wealth of beauty and potential. We probably go down every couple of years, obviously, to see family. Freycinet.
Yeah.
The whole Freycinet area is amazing. There's a berry farm on the way to Freycinet near the turnoff. I think it's Kate's Berries Farm, that's sort of well known, that we love going to every single time. How long have you been down there?
Look, we've had the place for, two and a half years or something. But
yeah.
Since the pandemic, I've repositioned myself here. So the Mumbrella office in Sydney is closed and we'll be to the other side of Christmas. So I might as well be here. So, so made that move just as the borders were closing in March. So that incredibly weird, stressful road trip from Sydney to Melbourne to take the Spirit of Tasmania across, literally as you know, right at the height of the, I guess, the, you know, those panicky early days, you know, this kind of apocalyptically quiet Hume Highway. It was very, very strange. You know, when you're kind of living through scenes and you think, okay, when they do the montage looking back at the, you know, the catastrophe, these are going to be some of the scenes. So it felt very much like that. And then of course, as I arrived into Tasmania, it was just as Northwest Tasmania had its hospitals outbreak. So I kind of went from 14 days home isolation into the Northwest, then having its own lockdown. So yes, and I've had to make a couple of quick trips back to New South Wales, then each time go back into 14 days home isolation again. So I was adding it up. I think I've probably done at least 40 or 50 days of, you know, proper home iso where you can't even go out for a walk. So
well, I was thinking, you know, like as an introvert at heart, you must like that in some way. And I was thinking, you know, every time, because I remember reading in the Best of the Week, like, you know, he's going back to Sydney again. This must be bizarre. And you mentioned, I think in the last one, that the flights have gone from, you know, completely, like there's just no one on them, to being sort of half full. But each time you get into Sydney, what's been like the one thing that you can't deal without that you've had to do? Like maybe there's a store you've had to go to or a cafe or a restaurant or something like that.
Do you know, funnily enough, I'm not sure it's even so much a pandemic thing as a just being somewhere relatively remote thing, which is there's a little general store here in Sisters Beach. They'll get in the local newspapers and they'll get in the Australian, but they don't have the AFR. Okay. I've long been by habit a print newspaper reader. So when I was in Sydney, I'd have them all home delivered. And I suspect that come early next year, I'll be back in Sydney again and we'll get back in the same habit. But yeah, I've become mainly an iPad reader of the, the facsimile editions. But yes, you in Sydney, you would find me in the coffee shop with my physical copy of the AFR, just because enjoying the luxury that I don't otherwise have at the moment.
What do you not want to change? What's a thing that you've loved that's been integrated as a part of society about lockdowns and, it may be something as simple as mask wearing during this whole stage.
I suppose, as you allude to it, I've mentioned a few times in writing Best of the Week from Umbrella, I am something of an introvert. So, hey, I'll always love to go and have, lunch or a coffee with individual contacts, but those big industry parties, which, you have to, not only am I an introvert, I'm also a prosopagnosiac, which means I'm absolutely terrible at recognizing people, and if there's a sort of sliding scale of that, I'm at least an 8. So I'm not quite up there with, there was that famous book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. So I'm not quite there, but I'm not far off. So not having to pretend to recognise people that I should recognise and don't industry parties is probably the thing that I'm really enjoying not doing at the moment.
Yeah. I think a lot of people who are in any space where you're required to go to a lot of those events, particularly when they're at night, and it will vary for people depending on their personal situation, but sometimes there is something excruciating about going to that versus having your regular routine at home at night, whether it's the gym, eating normal food and not picking off these plates. So I always find that my voice goes a bit hoarse at these events, because you're drinking and you're having to yell over people. So I don't think I've missed those too much, but then, there's the events people who have suffered from it. So
I think that's a really good point you make, because we are an industry where we do these events and alcohol is an intrinsic part. And even if you drink rather than being teetotal, there are nights where you could do without it, but just the peer pressure to drink, or just the sheer presence of alcohol all around you, free alcohol, you always go in with good intentions. Then you come away thinking, I shouldn't have had that fourth beer or whatever. So we are an industry that inherently is an unhealthy lifestyle to be in the long term, I think, if you're not really careful.
You mentioned before sitting down at the cafe, whether it's reading the physical paper, you've got an affinity for that. I always found growing up in a family that was involved in print, I always had an affinity for the smell of freshly printed paper. And it had me thinking about your own childhood. I know that, when you look at your career, there's obviously constant references to Tootlepip in the newsletter. So you're clearly from the south of England. I think it sort of seems like you grew up around Basingstoke, maybe Portsmouth area. You did your A-levels in journalism and world affairs. I'm curious, like what's sort of your earliest memory from your childhood?
Oh gosh. Well, look, let's go back a couple of things. So firstly, the minor point is Basingstoke rather than Basingstoke, but much, much more importantly, although I did do 3 months in Portsmouth, which was where I sort of, although I was already in employment in a newspaper by then, did my sort of, initial training, as a Southampton Football Club fan, Portsmouth are very much the enemy. So you know, it was kind of three month in scummers territory. But yes, I would never think of myself as having sort of grown up in Portsmouth. You know, they were just down the road. But yeah, early childhood. You're correct. I mostly grew up in the south of England. But yeah, I've got just slight flashbacks of growing up in the kind of, you know, in the Midlands of the UK, sort of, you know, near Birmingham. So it's probably lucky that I moved down when I was about five. Otherwise I would have had that sort of Birmingham accent, in which you can be incredibly intelligent and still sound incredibly dopey. Yeah. Just like, you know, nice cup of tea, and you just can't help but sound, you can't help but sound not very clever. So I was probably lucky that I moved just before I was, the habit had sunk in. Whereas once I got to Australia 13 years ago, there's no shaking my English accent.
Yeah, but also interesting, in Australia, there's probably no judgment on the accent. I remember having worked or come from the finance industry and then moving into marketing, sort of coming from marketing sales roles. I had good friends. You get a lot of British expats who come over from the UK to work in finance here, much like in media. And it was always really interesting to hear again about that issue of, you know, like one guy had a really strong Scouse accent and he was one of the most educated people you'd ever met and could probably run any desk in the city, but he could not get a job at a tier one organization simply because of the accent.
Yeah, you know, it's very, I suppose, yeah, two thoughts on that. One of the things is I only really notice if I'm back visiting the UK, just the sheer variety of accents. You know, you're just on a train and you're hearing so many different accents all of the time. You know, there's far more, I suppose, a melting point of that. But yeah, the other thing is absolutely, you know, the unconscious bias or stereotyping. Mm. You know, you hear a Scouse accent and you're expecting somebody who's a bit of a cheeky chappy ducker and diver. You know, you hear a kind of Southern Irish accent and you just trust them and they're likable. You know, there's just certain accents that have got so much associated with them. You know, I remember hearing a stand-up comedian kind of talk about the difference between the Australian accent, the New Zealand accent and the South African accent. So it's not my joke, but I remember them making the point that, you know, New Zealand just of the three sounds not too bright. I forget exactly what they write off Australian as, but I think we can fill in our own punchline. And then South African just sounds slightly evil.
Yeah. Yeah. There's the old classic. I don't know if you've heard the song, "I've Never Met a Nice South African." That was like the, there was like a
spitting
comedy
image.
Spitting image. In the '90s or something like that. That was an absolute classic.
It was, yes. We look back now and it was probably, although obviously it was at the height of apartheid, so there's a lot of judgment about South Africa, but I guess in its own right, it was kind of racist.
It was, it very much was, but it was quite funny.
It was number one hit, I think.
It was a big song at the time. I was looking at your early career and obviously you spent probably about, it looks like 16 years in the UK, various news and industry-specific publications. And it sort of seems like you then hopped, skipped and jumped over to Sydney via Dubai with, I don't know if the organisation in Dubai was sort of part of the LexisNexis parent organisation, but I'm just going to assume it may have been interrelated because you went LexisNexis, the organisation in Dubai, and then LexisNexis again in Sydney. So I was just curious, why Australia?
Yeah, look, I suppose, as you say, like, you know, I guess first half or so of my career was in the UK, and that in itself was probably a kind of career of two halves. And I came up through local newspapers and sort of, you know, and daily local newspapers as well. Then moved over to the kind of sort of, I suppose we call the specialist press or specialist journalism, of which that included a chunk of writing for the medical industry, writing for doctors. So a magazine called Hospital Doctor, which is a pretty good clue on who the readers were, but then moved over to become editor of Media Week in the UK. So that I suppose was when I started writing about our world and our industry. So Media Week in the UK was very much focused on the buying and selling of media. So people working in media agencies, people working in media sales. So that I suppose is, would, you know, I then sort of think there was a sort of logic to that where, you know, the first, so as you say, sort of, you know, as part of the, I guess, the distant LexisNexis family, when I was a hospital doctor, because it was owned by Reed Business Information, which ultimately was Reed Elsevier then. And then the you know, the weird thing about going from Media Week to Dubai was actually it was ITP, the company in Dubai, was a it was owned by expat Brits, but was a, you know, locally based, Dubai based publishing company, which their business model was very, and still is, I think, was very much about taking franchises. So often consumer facing ones, but one of the them was the Franchiser Campaign magazine, which was, you know, the advertising Bible in the UK. And the kind of deal, I think, was that they couldn't poach one of the editors who worked for Haymarket, who were the owners of Campaign. And Haymarket pretty much owned the whole industry apart from Media Week. So basically I was the only person in the UK who they could poach. So there wasn't a lot of competition for the role, but, but yeah, I went over to Dubai for, you know, I thought I'd probably do it for 2 years, and I think I lasted just over a year, and, you know, was glad I did it and even gladder to get out again. Thought that was it for my adventures, and I'd been back in the UK for about a week when these things always go through networks, don't they? I had a call from, you know, a friend of a friend who was looking for an editor of B&T magazine here in Australia, which was the advertising thing. So, you know, other than watching the Sydney Olympics on the telly and thinking, Australia looks quite nice, I'd never given much thought to being in Australia, really. So it wasn't a big plan.
Are you a citizen now?
Do you know, I'm just on the way, actually. So I've been a permanent resident for some time. And of course, once you have that, other than voting and, you know, a different coloured passport, there aren't too many options, but it seems like a sensible thing to do. So my application is pending, although I now learn that it takes something like 70% of applications actually are taking 30 months at the moment. So I'm not expecting to hear from Mr. Dutton anytime soon.
Wow, that's very interesting. Because, I mean, having those dual passports is very useful for many reasons. I remember my fiance's mother, she's actually from Leeds, and she was naturalized in the 90s. So I think she gave up her British passport. But even then, because she was a woman born before 87, her children can all get British citizenship automatically. You just have to apply. So we're looking at that whole process at the moment because, but then again, it may be made redundant because the whole new free trade agreement with the UK is all about cross-border movement between the UK and Australia.
Yes, although I'm not sure I'm seeing that many signs of the current UK government being that capable of negotiating a complex trade agreement, given their inability to find any sort of effective deal with Europe post-Brexit. So I guess let's wait and see. But now, of course, they've got Mr. Tony Abbott on the job, so I'm sure that everything will be fine.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll get it sorted and somehow throw in some Knights and Dames awards in there. So you're in Australia, obviously working at LexisNexis. So you mentioned before B&T magazine. You began Focal Attractions. There was three co-founders, obviously. I think it was 2008. So this is probably around the GFC. So Mumbrella, Encore Magazine, the BE Fest, ABIC, which was to do with adventure and backpacking, and then the Golden Backpack Awards, Backpacker Trader News. So there's a few things going on there. What was the gap that you identified in 2008 to say with your co-founders, okay, I'm in a foreign country, still not a resident, but I'm going to start this company?
Yeah, look, I suppose a couple of things. So I suppose one of the things that made it easy to make the jump, so I did, you know, it was 2 years to the day that I did B&T because that was what I promised my boss I'd do at least 2 years. So I thought I'd better stick to that. But yeah, one of the things that made it, I guess, easier to come across was Focal Attractions as a company already existed. So the guy who'd actually recruited me to B&T, a chap called Martin Lane, then while I was still waiting for my visa to come to Australia, rang me and said, by the way, we won't be working together because I'm leaving. So he went over to work with, so Martin is one of the co-founders, and then he went over to work with another, I told you it's all networks and mates, another former colleague of his who had ended up with the local franchise of TNT magazine, the Backpacker magazine. You know, you one of those things you'll probably only be familiar with if you hang out in backpacker bars, but yeah, so they, as well as sort of servicing the kind of, you know, I guess the consumer-facing backpacker world, decided, okay, there's something for the, you know, the adventure travel industry, I suppose. So they'd started some business-facing stuff, including, as you say, ABIC, which is the Venture Backpacker Industry Conference. So they sort of kept nagging me to come and join them and start something in our world, you know, the kind of media and marketing world. And I suppose it just gave me a little bit more confidence to kind of make the leap from a reasonably well-paid job to a startup, from the fact that they had at least got the you know, the backpacker industry stuff going. So there was a, you know, the conference was making a small amount of money and that sort of thing. So I sort of came over and was, you know, effectively sort of Mumbrella's, well, I think it was Focal Attractions' first employee, but Mumbrella's first employee as, you know, as we sort of, you know, prepared to kind of, you know, launch that. And in terms of the gap, I think the plan I had when we were starting was something different anyway. You know, I had in the back of my mind that actually you've got, you know, B&T, which has come up through the advertising world, particularly advertising agency world. And although I'd sort of widened the footprint a bit as editor, that was still where its heartland was. Similarly for Ad News, which was the other sort of print rival, was I had the sense that actually there could be a whole bunch of specialist newsletters on PDF was the terrible idea at the time. So there would be one for media agencies, which was, you know, it went back to the world I knew from Media Week in the UK. And again, they're an audience that lots of advertisers want to talk to because, you know, they spend money, so they have influence. So I thought we would do a series of PDFs, you know, one for public relations agencies, one for media agencies, one for creative agencies, and so on. And then we just need a receptacle to chuck all of this content once it had gone out in the PDF. So the, you know, the kind of the knocked together in WordPress receptacle was Mumbrella. Uh-huh. And then just because by the time I sort of, you know, finished at B&T in the October, it wasn't really worth starting the newsletters that side of Christmas. So I just got going with the website in early December. And fortunately, that was the bit that took off. So we never did do the terrible PDF idea.
Well, it was really interesting looking at those early interviews and discussions around that and how you sort of just offhandedly mention, you know, WordPress was a stable platform and it gave you something to work with. And, you know, I'm very fascinated by decentralized technologies. And it sort of seems at that beginning, or at least around the end of the GFC, is when we saw the first start of, let's call it that new media wave, where publishing in particular was being massively disrupted by social networks and platforms like WordPress. And it just had me thinking maybe what it was about Mumbrella, apart from your industry nous, was that you guys had an ability to understand, not directly, but maybe intuitively, that there was a cycle change happening. And something like WordPress may have been the thing that sort of pushed that through.
No, I think I possibly you give us too much credit because I think luck of timing comes into it. Because
that's a big thing.
Yeah, you know, and I think we were probably at the point where we were ready to give the business a go. But what gave us a bit of rocket fuel, you know, as you allude to, was that, yeah, WordPress has become, it had been around for a few years, but had become stable. So people, you know, people have been, you know, blogging for at least, I remember blogging for Campaign when I was in Dubai as well. So people have been blogging for at least 4 years, say. So let's say it was a, if not mainstream, relatively common thing from about probably 2004 onwards. So it got stable, you know. But again, I remember, you know, even at B&T, we went in and we were looking for we had a really clunky system of sending out emails. And, yeah. We went and just got quotes from, you know, to try and get something slightly better. And we've been quite like 30 grand or something just to build an email sending platform. And then, of course, by the time we were kicking off with Umbrella, just in the space of a few months, you know, we signed up for one called Constant Contact, $30 a month, you know, so yeah. Everything was changing at once. And, of course, it was just as Twitter was coming through as well, which, you know, for a while was absolutely the right way of communicating with sort of Umbrella's slightly sort of early adopter communications industry audience. So of course, you know, it became this virtuous circle where I'd write an article, be able to post it really quickly and efficiently. I'd not having the distraction of having a print product as well. I'd then be able to tweet it. That would send in an engaged audience who would join the comment thread, which again was quite a new thing. And that meant that by the time I then sent out an email to the rest of our audience, there was already a conversation going on the comment thread. So it then became sort of self-sustaining. So I think it's very easy to post-rationalize that weren't we clever to see that opportunity. But, you know, hey, we worked very, very hard. And that was the bit where we made our luck, rather than in any particular piece of wisdom. You know, we worked hard, but also got lucky in timing.
Well, that's what I was thinking, is the timing of the new cycle was very interesting. I mean, even if you look at some of your competitor products today, and I chat to someone like Dan Monheit regularly, who we've had as guests in the past. And
yes, I do like Dan's podcast, actually. Yeah. Was it Bad Decisions? Is that what it's called?
Bad Decisions. Great show that anyone should listen to.
If you like behavioral economics, then it's a very good explainer.
It's amazing. And they just covered the big one recently, which is the Dunning-Kruger effect, which was a fascinating episode. So,
yes. Now, I've not listened yet, but it's on my list. Great. So I believe. So if I understand rightly, and this is terrible explaining something I've not listened to yet, but this is the idea that you raise one level above your actual competence. Is that the effect?
Yeah. Well, I always thought it was. If I look it up now to see what the actual definition is, I always thought it was when you hear someone speak about a topic that you know a lot about. And it sort of enlightens you to the fact that they actually don't know as much as they think they do.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So that is the inverse of it. Actually, what it is, a cognitive bias in which people with low ability at a task overestimate their ability. So I always thought that the Dunning-Kruger effect was that enlightenment for the person listening rather than the unawareness of the individual who was actually talking about the topic.
I guess it types into this idea that, you know,
which shows I know very little.
Yes. And I suppose it taps into the idea that, you know, you talk to many men and they and ask the question, do you think you could take a point off Serena Williams at tennis? And they believe they can, which is clearly not as well. But it also shows that I really should listen to that latest episode as well.
Yeah, it's a great episode. And we were talking recently about other industry publications. And I looked at them and what was most enlightening to me was still that let's say even if their website from an infrastructure point of view are on WordPress, they still don't have the interface that Umbrella has done really well and the distribution mechanisms that you've done well. So yes, I do think it was timing, but I think it was that embracement of the product at the time that probably held you pretty well. And it had me thinking, like, what are, because I've seen here and there you're mucking around with other new forms of media, let's say. What's sort of the newest frontiers of media that interests you the most at the moment?
Interesting. Yeah, personally, look, I've dabbled with it a little bit, as you alluded to at the start, and currently on long service leave where I write a book. So it's sort of been, the project's on pause, but something that I was just beginning to dabble with until then was I'm really interested in the whole kind of ecosystem that's growing up around Substack, which is the email platform, you know, and particularly out the US, you're seeing a lot of, you know, almost journalists trying to become brands in their own right. And I think particularly in the, you know, in the kind of sort of business journalism side of things, you know, so there's this real wave of journalists going to Substack, or journalists still employed by, you know, the big publishers, but running their own Substack along with it. And, you know, when they sign deals to come on board, the deal being they're allowed to take their list at the end. So it's almost like, you know, you start thinking of it a bit almost like sort of, you know, a footballer being hired for a particular sort of talent and coming out. So that's really interesting. So far I dabbled with a few Substack posts, almost to try and just understand the platform and try it rather than yet try and monetize it, which I haven't flicked the switch on and don't have any plans to. But you know, just because it feels like so much of what comes up and is new is until you actually try it hands on, it's a lot harder to write about it until you've tried it and lived with it for a while. Hey, look, I've always felt that generally, email has been this really underrated platform over the years. So it feels like maybe it's about to have its second coming in the way that podcasts have been having their second coming.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious then what it is about Substack that interests you. I mean, if I think about my own consumption recently, there was a few emails that I subscribed to, two in particular. One is called The Business of Content with Simon Owens. And the second one is called Value Investing World. And that's more from the finance side of things. I can't remember who actually publishes it, but they're about $5 a month. And they were valuable enough for me that when they moved from doing free publishing with their own email list to Substack, I was like, well, I've got to have this because I felt like I would have been losing that insight. Why do you think Substack has changed that perception in particular?
Look, I think the main thing is they make it very, very easy just to create and publish for the journalist. And then they will handle the monetizing side of it, the taking the money for subscriptions, all of those fiddly bits, which, you know, most journalists are not particularly tech savvy. So just taking away that is worth giving, certainly until you reach a certain scale, is worth to a lot of journalists, worth giving Substack a big slice of the of those subscription revenues to just take away the hassle. So I think so much of it is about the fact that you can just publish, which if I think about the early days of Umbrella, when we were a very small team, you know, it was just me writing, I was able to spend 95% of my time writing.
Which
is what you want, because that's the content, that's the product, that's the thing that's going to make the difference, you know. So there was none, which is one of the many reasons why the PDF was a bad idea, because there would have been so much production would have gone in that would have taken, you know, time away from the kind of the writing side of things. So of course you've got to have domain expertise and, you know, an ability to write and all of those things as well. But it just removes some of those barriers. So that I guess is what interests me about Substack now, is it feels a bit like WordPress back then. It's removing a few barriers. And I suspect what we'll see is a lot of journalists who make a go of it 2 or 3 years down the track, unless Substack evolves, will probably pull out again because it won't give them the sophistication they might then want on managing their lists and stuff. But as a crude entry point, it's really interesting because it seems to be creating a shift in, you know, where, if not where journalists are making their living, where they're going to have a go. So that, you know, it's people having a go. I'm not sure we've got all of the case studies of success yet, but that's a really interesting one to watch for me.
Yeah. And I think the change in the publishing landscape would have brought that on a lot sooner as well. I think it will be interesting to see what happens. You mentioned before about the fact that this platform allows people to focus on creative more than anything. And it was really interesting reading your media diet from a few years ago on crikey.com on that interview. I think they were interviewing people about the quality of journalism.
Gosh, do you know, it's funny how these things pop up and you don't even remember them. It's one of the things we've been doing the book is I'm finding these videos I shot 10 years ago interviewing people and I don't even remember the fact that I interviewed them. But I'm intrigued to hear what was in the Crikey one.
Well, I would assume that it's somewhat changed. I know in it you spoke about quality journalism, and it just had me thinking about your own principles. So, and I mean, the thing that interests me most is interviews. And I know you still do interviews, of course, for the podcast. So maybe we'll focus on that. And I was curious as to what your research process looks like. Is it as simple as consuming as much information as possible and then waiting until the point hits when you've got enough and then just writing? How does that actually look?
You mean specific for interviews or preparing for interviews or
preparing for interviews? And then if you were to look back in your previous life when you were writing a lot more as the editor, obviously you're on long service leave, so you're probably not writing as much as you were back, you know, 2 years ago. But I guess I'm curious, starting with interviews and then moving into news pieces.
Look, and I suppose, you know, at any given period in my time with Mumbrella, there's been a different rhythm to what I was doing, you know. So when I was the one and only writer, obviously I was doing one thing, and then, you know, as the team grew and I was, you know, managing other journalists, etc. But, you know, if I think back, like in the early days, you'd be writing a diet of one fact news stories where it was just you wanted to be maybe first to tell your audience something had happened, whether it was, you know, I don't know, this agency has won this important piece of business or, you know, a big move at one of the media companies or whatever. And they were, the bread and butter. But when it came to kind of writing the opinion pieces, then what you were really looking for was an original thought that was usually, it was one point argued well, that hopefully you were making a new point, and that you were waiting for it to bubble up. You know, sometimes it was obvious something had happened, so I'm going to explain why it's important. But other times it's just the thought comes into your head and you think, well, I have a point of view on that. But again, at the same time, you know, we were, you know, as you say, with the weekly podcast, we still have guests on. So there's obviously a lot of prep for that. And back in the day, we used to shoot a lot more video than we do now. And, you know, the way we used to do them, which it was completely, well, it was certainly unmonetized, and we found it unmonetizable as well. Mm. So we're obviously doing it for other reasons. We used to have a fairly high production level for our video shoots. So we'd do them at a professional studio. You know, there'd be a professional camera operator, a professional sound person. You know, we had a sort of producer lining up the lining up the guests, and we'd shoot for one afternoon and we'd knock off five or six guests, and between each guest I'd just go and change my t-shirt, and then we'd put the videos up over 5 or 6 weeks, and we'd maybe have them in, you know, broken into 2 or 3 episodes over the days. So you'd get 6 weeks worth of material from one shoot. But and that was like the when I was the only journal and we were still trying to put something out every day. Obviously, that was, you know, that was almost like an efficiency that we had to have. But what it meant was it was very demanding in the night before. It was the night before when I was trying to prep 6 interviews and you know, have enough knowledge of the, you know, of the guests that they were going to be, you know, I was going to have some interesting questions. Generally, you know, and when you got really good guests, it was usually because they had a book out or something. So you would have had to get the most out of it. You would have had to have read the book probably, you know. So, and the thing is, and you watch those videos back now and they stand the test of time quite well, you know. So,
well, you know, it was very interesting looking at them. They're still all there on YouTube. And some of them are fascinating. Like you're talking about Mia Friedman, probably at or just before she began Mamma Mia itself. I think she'd launched.
Yeah, it was a tiny little blog at that point. She'd launched. She just published the book Mamma Mia as well. She'd left ACP magazines, where she was one of the kind of, the mavens, and then had a sort of very short and unpleasant time at Channel 9, which I still remember asking her which actually went up in a separate video, I think, when we put together everyone's answers, because, what was the worst thing about working in the industry? Like, we'd done best and worst. Her answer for the best thing about Channel 9 was they employed so many women that there was never a queue for the toilets when he wanted to go and have a cry. Which probably summed up the kind of toxic atmosphere at Channel 9 in about 2008, 2009. There were some really interesting, sort of videos. I feel so lucky it was a route to meet some really interesting people I never would have done. So Anthony Bourdain, I absolutely adored his writing. Yeah. The late Anthony Bourdain, to have interviewed him was amazing. Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, although it ruined Mad Men for me, because I remember preparing for it, for the interview, I'd not seen, I think only season one or two were out at the time, and I had like 48 hours notice, so I just had to basically watch the whole the first two seasons in about 48 hours flat, not really sleeping. Jeez. And it ruined Mad Men, and I finally only went back to it about 7 or 8 years on, so just recently finally did Mad Men.
That's so funny, because
wonderful.
I did that as well in lockdown. Like, I'd watched the first season and I sort of disliked it. And then we really got into it probably in March and watched all seasons. I think there was 6 or 7. I was disappointed by the ending, but it was sort of obvious to me that they were trying to wrap things up.
Yeah, look, I think... do we need to do a spoiler alert for something that's so old?
But, yeah, spoiler alert if you haven't listened to it. But it's a long time ago, I feel.
Yes, it is. But yeah, so effectively, like, the and that last thing is Don's basically blown up, as he was always going to, and he's left the agency and he's off with his hippie commune, and then he's kind of like, and they're off doing yoga on a hillside or something, and he kind of smiles to himself for a moment, you think, oh, he's at peace. But then the very final scene is that famous Coca-Cola, I want to teach the world to sing. And I'm sure you're meant to think that actually Don went back to the agency
and
created the most famous ad of all time. I don't know if that's a happy ending or not. I mean, most people who've been in advertising and have left, I tend to find are happier than when they were there.
we were debating that as well, like, what is the actual ending? But I think you're right. I think you can't really what else can you surmise from the end of it?
Yeah.
Like, why would they play that ad?
Yeah, that for me, it's that and the fact that it's just, if you think about everything that's happened in previous seasons where Don has got, or Peggy have got their inspirations for pieces of advertising from their lives, they've got the insights. Yeah. I think we were seeing the moment where Don got the insight for this ad.
Yeah.
So that's my guess. But, I guess we can debate it as much as the final scene of The Sopranos as well.
I've never watched The Sopranos. It's something that people have recommended. So.
Oh, look, definitely. Well, look, there's some shared DNA with Mad Men, because Matt Weiner was involved in The Sopranos as well. So I'm absolutely not going to do a spoiler for you on the last scene then, but I can't get into that one without ruining it for you, but I strongly recommend it, and I can never hear the song Don't Stop Believing from Journey in the same way anymore since seeing that.
With your interviews now today, and most of these are probably podcast interviews, how long do you think that you spend research wise
look, longer than the interview takes, that's for sure. Some of them it kind of depends a bit on who the person is, how much you've been writing about them recently. Like, the very you know, the very last interview I did for the Umbrella Cast was Sir Martin Sorrell, former boss of WPP. And I guess I followed his story quite well and over the years, and interviewed him in various different formats over the years at various points. So I've at least got a bit of a thought. But I would have probably spent, certainly a few hours just, and different people, they have their different things. His is, famously, he'll get quite cross with the journals if it becomes evident they've not read the most recent annual report. So, to read the most recent annual report, things like that. So, it sort of depends. But, I honestly think that you've got to do some prep. So and it's amazing how much goes out of your head if you don't just have a few bullet points of a few things that you will have, you do want to cover, because otherwise it's a it's a bit like a conversation. We think after, I wish I mentioned such and such. At least having the bullet points and the things you really want to cover. So more prep than is probably necessarily justified on the obvious investment of your time. What am I saying? It's a bit like data journalism. Someone described data journalism to me as a great way of hiding work. And probably shooting video interviews is much the same. Like, you're probably, certainly for the sort of niche Umbrellas in, when we were doing video, we were hardly getting any views. Yeah. So you're doing it for posterity and to earn the respect of, as much as anything, the people you're talking to, and to talk to people you otherwise wouldn't talk to, and all those things. You're not doing it to monetize, because it's never going to pay off. And it's probably the same. You could go in and interview someone cold and it would be fine, but you'll know deep down that if you just drilled a bit further, then you could have got something a bit more interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, look, I think in a lot of these interviews, there's a decent amount of views now, considering how old they are. They give you a credibility in those early years to open up conversations you wouldn't normally have, which is what
totally, yeah. And one of the things was, as I say, we had Brooke, the producer, who was really good at getting good interviewees. And it's one of those things is, you can't just ring up on the day and say, "Can I talk to Malcolm Turnbull?" But if you put the work in and you book it in a month out, you might. Or similarly, when, as I say, when people are promoting a book or whatever. So they give you an opportunity to talk to someone in a way you otherwise probably wouldn't on the day.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of groundwork that people don't see. It's always very funny when we do an interview and someone messages us and says, "Hey, you should interview this person." I'm like, "Yeah, no worries. I'll just pick up the phone today and give them a call." But then, that being said, I'm often surprised by how quickly some people respond. Like, I noticed Russell Howcroft, who we had on recently, like, responded within a couple of hours. He's like, "Yeah, sure."
Yeah, look, and he's good. And the thing is, Russell works very, very hard, loves the advertising industry, and has a new gig to promote at the moment, because he's just become the host at 3AW. And he's a professional. He knows that the time to market your new thing is at the start. So he could just be a complacent fat cat if he wants to be. He's kind of earned it, but he still seems to work just as hard. So yeah. I'm not surprised to hear that he came back so quickly at all.
Yeah, he loves it. He's got a passion for the industry, that's for sure. Speaking of radio and podcasting, I'm not sure if you still fall asleep to ABC Radio National or podcasts at night, but I know, obviously, as we mentioned before, you still dabble in the hosting of the Umbrella Cast. We've got a creative and production agency that does do podcasting, and there are obvious pros and cons, I think, with any medium. Some of those, I think, for podcasting may be the quality of attention you can get with podcasting, whereas the deficits may be sort of on the data side, which the industry is still figuring out. I was curious, like, how do you see that medium going over the next 5 years, now that it seemed to have had sort of this key bull run, you could call it, over the last 18 to 24 months?
Yeah, we are. And I can't work out. I said second wave. It might even be the third wave. Because I remember, like, being a massive fan would have been 12 years, 13 years ago, of The Guardian in the UK used to do a media podcast that was really good, and being a massive fan of that. And then they stopped it because I guess they didn't judge it was worth the investment of time, or they weren't getting the advertising against it. And I remember, you know, the presenter, I think was Emily Bell at the time, sort of saying, you know, yeah, we seem to be stopping it just as podcasting's having its second coming. And they were possibly right about that. But you know, I suppose it kind of came back again. I think an awful lot of it was the startup phenomenon. Mm. You know, that the podcast done by Gimlet Media, you know, the story of the startup, which almost created, I think, the noise and excitement about the sector. And then, of course, Serial came through as the spin-off from This American Life. And again, that created more excitement again. So it began to sort of, I guess, spin up, certainly as a consumer habit. But of course, just because it's a consumer habit doesn't automatically mean it's monetizable. And I think that's been one of the challenges, and probably still is. You know, as you say, I think data's the thing that, you know, the technology is still kind of clunky, really.
It is.
You know, certainly I've not come across the perfect, podcast app yet, for instance, from the user point of view. You know, the flexibility of getting, you know, ads in is still kind of tricky. And also, of course, you've just got this scalability thing as well, where the best ads for a podcast are the ones that are some form of live read, probably, or at least tailored for the very, very specific audience, and a really tailored message about, you know, what the brand is to that audience. So that obviously really affects scale, but also probably really affects the ability to sell into the, you know, into people of scale. So there are still a lot of barriers, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the media buying, I think reading Pod News, what was the media buy in the industry recently? Someone was like, oh, wow, it's $1 billion. And I'm like, in my head, like, that's nothing.
Yeah. And most of that's the US anyway.
Yeah, it's all the US predominantly. I think you're right. I think we've had this second wave that was started by the sort of Gimlet and NPRs of the world.
Yeah.
And what brought it or strung it along was personalities, particularly in areas like comedy, TV, et cetera, using it as another channel. On top of, say, YouTube or with YouTube to build their audience, but it has all been US related. Monetization's an interesting one. I think it does have a ways to go. We get hit up all the time, and that the ad opportunities are never worth it. And we took the approach that we actually built an agency behind it as the way to monetize.
Yeah.
Which has worked out much better, I think, than if we'd ever focused on ads and continued creating media.
Look, and I think the other sort of, I guess, unsettled bit of the ecosystem is the players like Spotify.
Yeah, well, that's the big thing, Spotify.
Yeah. I read a really good thought piece from, it's somebody I subscribed to on Substack, funnily enough, who's an early stage investor. And she'd done a piece on the investment case for Spotify. Mm-hmm. And one of her arguments on why, and her name is Jax, J-A-X, but I can't remember her second name, but it'll probably come back to me in a minute. Funnily enough, the thing that made me subscribe was I was on the Innovation Bay podcast with her 2 or 3 weeks
ago.
And I thought, oh, she's super smart. I'm going to subscribe to her Substack. But one of the points she made in her kind of investment case, which was she was making a kind of the bull investment case, the pro investment case, was where she potentially saw a lot more growth to come if you were, for instance, an investor, would be at the moment they're spending an awful lot of money on handing over money for the streaming rights to the music companies.
Yeah.
Whereas if you can pivot to a far bigger part of your package being talk, and you're creating those podcasts yourself, the relative cost of those minutes is so much less. So that will probably make some podcast creators, particularly the mainstream mass reach ones, rich, but it will probably create some walled gardens that aren't there at the moment. So
yeah. Spotify is the big one with that people keep referencing. The big issue there is, the most interesting thing to come out recently was that licensing deal, obviously between Joe Rogan and Spotify, but it's also extended to others. Like, I'm pretty sure Michelle Obama was with Luminary and she's recently moved to Spotify. So yeah, I think that licensing will allow the big players to monetize.
Yeah. And then we're seeing, you know, the likes of Audible are funding, even in Australia, are funding specific shows, you know. So yeah, there's a bit of a land grab going on there, I think.
There's a huge land grab. And I think Apple's wised up in that regards in terms of hiring people. I think the best place to really get an understanding of what's going on there is always is Pod News.
Quidland. James Quidland. Yes.
He's probably the best for that sort of stuff. And it's had me think, I was curious to get your opinion on radio, because I still listen to radio shows, like in particular KISS shows. Like, I don't know why, but Jason PJ I quite like. And every now and then I'll double in Kyle and Jackie O, maybe for a bit of nostalgia. But I'm listening to them on the podcast app. So I'm never listening to them live. I can't deal with the ad experience. It's quite frustrating. I understand that they have to have ads to monetize, but the experience you get on the podcast app is much better. Where do you see radio going? Does it still, I would assume it's going the way of TV, which is news and live moments. Where do you sort of see that going?
Yeah, I guess I think you probably summed it up really. For the, you know, the utility of radio is when you want something live, and that could include as simple as when you're commuting, you know, when you're in the car or whatever. Then you know you want to know what's going on in your city right now, and you're on the way to work. Those sort of moments. Clearly, the radio industry itself is trying to work out what radio is. You know, is it a live thing? You know, I remember years and years ago being at a radio conference and, you know, one of the sort of, you know, I guess some sort of consultant saying, you know, the definition of a really good breakfast show is it could only go out on that day in that city, which sort of seems to go away a bit about the definitions of a podcast, you know. And I listen to loads. Funny enough, I was just last night listening to James Cridland on the Media Report, Dan Barrett's new podcast.
Oh, really?
Talking about podcasting. So it's all getting a little bit meta. But you know, if you think about, and he was talking about, amongst other things, Hamish and Andy. And if you think about the Hamish and Andy podcast, it almost sprang out of, after they left Southern Cross or Stereo, for the first year or so, they carried on creating what was effectively a podcast that also got broadcast. And then at some point it just stopped getting broadcast. And it feels to me now, I'm not sure it has the rhythm of a radio show anymore. So I don't think if Southern Cross or Stereo were just to rebroadcast it, whether it would necessarily work anymore. But it does feel like, you must think there's such an opportunity for the radio companies because they have such an expertise in creating good audio content. You need more of a setup than is obvious. I mean, it's, you know, $200 microphone will probably do the job for the microphone and so on. But there's a lot of people making podcasts that haven't taken the trouble of getting the $200 microphone.
No. And there's the fact that producer talent is something I found just, speaking to people, interviewing people in radio is something that you do really need to invest in, because it can't just all be about the person who's hosting the show, running everything. You need to bring in other people.
This is a really good point you make. I don't know if you ever listened to the Fear and Greed podcast, which is the one that, so this is kind of for the, I guess, about finance and economics. So it's done by Sean Aylmer, who used to be at the AFR and BRW before that. He presents, it's a three-man band, basically. He presents it. Guy called Michael Thompson is the producer, who's ex-Macquarie Media, so, you know, 2GB, et cetera. And then the guy who sort of, as far as I can tell, running the business is Adam Lang, who again was boss of Macquarie Media. So it's the three of them, but Sean presents it. It's twice a day. So there's a morning bulletin, effectively, which drops in your inbox at 6:30, and it's short and sharp, probably maybe 10 minutes. It's what's been going on with the news of the day. And then a very quick interview with someone, 5 or 6 minutes. And then there's an afternoon wrap that's even shorter when the markets close. But one of the things I found fascinating about the interview is they'll also then put up, so actually it's three pieces of content a day, because they'll also put up the extended version of the interview as well. And when you listen back to that, you realize just how much production has gone into the version of the interview that goes into the main podcast so they can keep it tight. So generally a 20-minute interview is cut down to 5 or 6 minutes really cleanly. You know, you wouldn't even tell necessarily that you're missing much, but you know, some answers are shortened to get to the point, some are taken out altogether, but it still works really coherently. So there's a producer behind the scenes who's working every bit as hard as the presenter. Yeah. You know, so there's a lot more to it than that, you know, again. And it goes back to that, you know, that point. Now, maybe that's what will give it a secret sauce and help it succeed. But again, so much podcasting is it can be a great way of hiding work.
That's true. Yeah, there's many things like that that I feel like people who come from the indie space forget. And the thing that triggered my mind is that investment in production talent was when Jason PJ went from New Zealand to Australia, and what they showed, what was happening in New Zealand, is that the networks didn't really invest in producer talent. So they selected their own. And it just meant that they could own more of their show and elements of the content channels that they had. But, you know, those things are really, really important. And it's sort of, you don't see the effects of that in the short term, it's the long term.
I've been in their studio when they've been on air. They've got a big production team here in Australia, in Melbourne as well. Like there's a lot to it now, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a big team. I feel like there's at least 5 team members, 6 team members there.
Yes.
I would say you've probably built somewhat of an institution that could probably and probably will survive the original founders of the business. Now that you're sort of taking the role of you know, wise old man on long service leave writing his book, and you've allowed future leaders in the organization to develop. What seems obvious to you right now about the media industry, but not to others?
I don't know is the most honest first part of that. And it might be something the light bulb will come to me in 5 minutes as we're chatting. Yeah, I don't fully know the answer to that question. What's it not? What seems obvious but isn't?
Do you think, and it's so hard to say when you're looking in hindsight, but, you know, did you feel that the changes that have happened in the last, let's say, 8 years in particular, with the impact that social media has had on the industry, were clear to you back then as they are to people in the industry now?
Look, I suppose, that's a good question, because there are definitely certain issues or trends that there's no one day that's the day they ring the bell and say, this is the thing. But then you look back, you know, but if you look at the way that, hey, the TV industry evolved in Australia, you know, you've got 11 or 12 years ago, you've got this thing called Hulu in the US, which is effectively it's an advertising supported streaming platform of, you know, some of the commercial players, and maybe will it come to Australia? Won't it? The negotiations are happening, and then it falls over and it doesn't. And we now realize what a missed opportunity that was. Then you've got, you know, what didn't seem very obvious prospects of success with the launch of Stan, for instance, which, you know, I think Nine wanted all sorts of, you know, knocked on every door to try and get a partner for that, struggled. And in the end, almost like, you know, the last girl left at the dance was Fairfax that said yes. And effectively it was what saved Fairfax shareholders from, you know, losing every dollar when it became a really valuable property, you know. But similarly, you know, you've got TV. 10 years ago, all the networks were such good haters with each other. They were all each other's enemies. You know, honestly, it was such a gift for the trade press, because every day the PR people from the rival networks would be sending you clips of how their rivals had stuffed up. And it would just, you know, there were so many, you know, stories and issues, and they were just, you know, and they were, I don't think they're quite as bad now, but maybe they're still a bit naughty on it, but they'd have to pull all of these tricks about deliberately overrunning or underrunning just to stuff the other people's schedules and hang on to viewers. But for the viewers, it was completely baffling. And then at some point, the penny dropped that the real enemy for the TV networks was digital disruption, and maybe Google's and Facebook's and those sort of things. So that was all quite a long sweep for them to realise that. And then, you know, and it's similarly, you know, if you think about what, you know, News Corp would rail against a decade ago, it was the aggregators. Like there was a speech where John Hardigan, the CEO of News Corp, you know, he talked about the problem being the aggregators, and he name checked Crikey and Mumbrella as, you know, not necessarily being the cause of all of their woes, but certainly one of them, and with barely a mention of Facebook and Google.
Really?
And of course, you know, now a few years on, you know, the common enemy of the traditional media is, I think they've got their heads together and they've agreed that actually it's Google and Facebook is the issue. So I think a lot of that takes a while to kind of, you know, sweep through. And you also realize when you look back, it didn't necessarily, it was never automatic it was going to come out this way. You know, the number of circumstances that meant that our two big players, local players now, are News Corp and Nine. You know, the things that had to happen for Nine and Fairfax to come together as a merger, you know, and the things that could have knocked it off in a different direction along the way. It was never a certainty, but I think that's the things. We get to a kind of an established equilibrium, and then we kind of forget it could so easily have gone a different way. You know, if Lachlan Murdoch and James Packer had succeeded in taking over 10, that would have put 10 in time with News Corp, and that would have been a different story. If Anthony Catalano hadn't been made redundant from Fairfax and gone away and started the Melbourne Weekly Review and stolen all of Fairfax's recruitment revenue, that meant they had to buy him back, which then brought him back in to help do the domain float, which was what got the value back into Fairfax. There wouldn't have been something worth Nine doing the merger with. The Nine shareholders would never have allowed it. All of these things, you know, just could have easily turned in a different direction. Yet we sit here now and it all seemed like it was always going to end up this way.
It seems like a fait accompli. The interesting thing now is, what I'm wondering about is, now that traditional media has worked out who the enemy is and there's this traditional versus digital, what does that mean for creatives and creators in particular, as this sort of arms race is well and truly underway, whether it's in streaming, music, audio, et cetera? There's a fight somewhere for attention, and that raises prices. So it's going to be very interesting to see the next couple of years in that regard. I've got to ask, in terms of your future, why it seems everything is about the current book. I know you can't speak about titles, but what's it about?
Yeah, so about, well, it's about 100,000 words, boom, boom. But a few months ago I was... had a bit of an idea, so I began to work on a synopsis, you know, two or three pages, really looking at, which is relevant to the conversation we've just been having, the development of the media over the last decade. So that 11-year decade, 2010 to 2020. And I just happened to get into an email conversation with... somebody working at one of the big publishers who reads the Mumbrella Best of the Week email, the Saturday email that I write. And, you know, we got into an email conversation, and then I kind of sort of said, well, I as it happens, I do have a synopsis at the moment, which then, you know, fairly quickly became a contract, with a deadline that's, as I speak to you, 61 days away to file my 80,000 to 100,000 words. So it's very much, it's trying to, I guess, A, tell the story of what happens to the media in Australia over the last decade, but also, yeah, understand the trends underlying it, and I guess the personalities as well. So it's a relatively complex story to tell. I'll you can just see, just sneaking yes, in the side there. So that's my sort of grid of what I saw as the key moment. So kind of going downwards, I've got each organization, you know, so you've got News Corp, 10, 9, Fairfax magazines, etc., and then sort of divided by the years down the side, 2010 to 2020. But then to try and stitch that into a coherent story has been the challenge, which I'm currently working through.
Part of that story, will it look to predict or talk about the future at all, do you think?
Look, I'm not so sure about that, actually, just because, I'm a big fan of Ogilvy and advertising. David Ogilvy's book from, I think 1984 or something, and he was towards the end of his career at that point. And it's a wonderful book, but his predictions are absolutely lousy. I'm just going to go and get it off the shelf, but
yeah,
this is going to take a moment to unzip myself. There we go. So, yeah, so this is... annoyingly, I can't quite bring myself to buy another copy, but there's a much more iconic version of the cover than this one.
I was going to buy this recently on Amazon.
Oh, do it. I really recommend it. It's a great book. But the one thing where he gets completely wrong is right at the end, I predict 13 changes. And he gives the caveat, I've never been a futurist, but every passing year, my interest in the future declines. However, my publisher insists that I take a shot at predicting the changes that you, gentle reader, will see in the advertising business. So, and the thing is, he was such a curmudgeon that I don't know why he gave in on this, but some of his predictions, there'll be a renaissance in print advertising. Advertising will contain more information and less hot air.
Wow.
And this, as I say, there are 13 of them, but this is probably the one which I think was wishful thinking on his part because he didn't like them. Billboards will be abolished. So the thing is, and it's wonderful. Like you can see, it's riddled with all my little post-it notes of all of his wonderful pieces of wisdom. But yeah, that was the one thing that if David Ogilvy could get so much wrong in predictions, then, and the thing is, you know, I guess the problem of making a career as a futurist is at some point the future comes along. So, you know, it's a bit like Ross Dawson, is that his name? Yes, I think it is, who did the newspaper Extinction Timeline. And you know, I think based on the... And obviously he gave it caveats, and he always says he gave it caveats, but based on the timeline he drew up, which got a lot of attention at the time, newspapers are all dead now.
Yeah, I think futurists, if you actually look at their prediction, or analysts that you get on news programs, they're really are like 50-50 in most cases. Like I would say they'd be under 50% as an average, an industry average.
Look, I suppose, and I guess it's how do you think of yourself as a, you know, if it's to be an interesting provocateur and have a point of view. You know, I like the Scott Galloway thing of, you know, I'm a seeker of truth, but not a teller of truth. And, you know, my job is to make predictions and be a catalyst, you know. So I guess if that's the definition of a, you know, a kind of a futurist, then fair enough. It's like, you know, somewhere up on that shelf, there's a book by the media agency PhD Merge about the emergence of artificial intelligence, and it's pretty stark. And I remember talking to one of the people behind it, and I say, surely you don't believe all this stuff. He said, well, you know, it's a point of view.
It reminds me that every time I read anything on AI, there was that book, I think it was Superpower by the AI researcher from Oxford.
I want to Kurzel, Wurzel, something like that.
It's not Kurzel.
Right.
It's going to bug me now.
Ah.
But it's got an owl on the front. Mm. And I
haven't seen it.
I just find those books, sorry, it's not Superpower, it's Superintelligence.
Right.
Nick Bostrom, I think he's from Oxford.
And you recommend it?
No, it's a very boring read. I tend to watch someone like Elon Musk talk about it. But yes. Anyway, now I want to jump into some rapid fire questions to finish things off. So speaking of books, if there was one that you had to give to the audience over the next year, what would the book be and why?
Well, look, I mean, I might have to pick two because number one is, you know, the one I always give to my journalists is, you know, if we have a new journalist join, I always recommend Ogilvy on Advertising for just that overview mm-hmm. of the industry and our world. And I'm not sure I can necessarily recommend a modern day version. I've just finally got around to reading Frenemies by Ken Ayeta, and I definitely don't recommend that. That's really plodding.
Like, I've had a book recently that I feel I can recommend to anyone, yes. and that was Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari.
Look, I'm a big fan, actually. Yeah, that's great. And I've got Homo Deus is just as good. In fact, arguably, and I, although obviously he wrote Sapiens first and then Homo Deus afterwards, I think you'd like, if you want to just fast forward, I'll go straight to Homo Deus. And he revisits a few of the same ideas, I think. But obviously Sapiens is, Sapiens is how we got here, and Homo Deus is where we might be going. And yeah, they're both really terrific books.
Incredibly well written, both yes. of them. For me as a history buff, Sapiens was just fascinating. I think it gives a lot of people perspective more than anything.
Yeah. And I haven't yet read, but it's on my shelf. I'm trying to remember what it's called. 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, which is his newish one. Have you had a chance to read
it? I heard him speaking on Sam Harris's podcast about it, but I haven't ordered it yet. I just ordered a bunch of 10 books from Amazon that I've started reading. So I have to wait probably till January till I can order some new ones, but it's on my list.
Look, I must admit, and I'm not going to tell you which one on the podcast, but I'll tell you afterwards if you like, because I just don't want anyone else sneaking in. I found a wonderful secondhand book site that has so many good books on, and new books go on every day. And my, you know, I probably, and you know, generally they're about $5 or $6 a time. So I'll generally order, you know, probably 20 or $25 worth of books a week, probably.
That's
so
awesome.
Saving a fortune.
Because buying books, like if I look at my Amazon list at the moment, it's currently about $4,000 and it's only about 60 books or something like that.
Well, I recommend going onto this site and just one at a time typing in the names of those books, and anything that's more than a couple of years old, I get a really strong hit rate. I picked up Nudge the other day, for instance, for $5.
Really? Jeez. Yeah. Yes, I will grab that link for you for sure, from you for sure. Last question for you. If you could have a billboard anywhere in Australia, where would it be, first of all? So think about location. And then what would it say, or what would you put on it?
I don't know, but while I'm playing for time, let me tell you about the story that of the billboard on Broadway in Sydney. We, one of the media agencies, I think it was, it was Mediacom, won some sort of contest with the billboard company, which I think was APN, if I remember rightly. Uh-huh. They won a billboard. So they weren't sure what to do. It was the really giant one up above the Broadway shopping center in Sydney. They couldn't think what to put on it, and they were getting really angsty about, well, look, we're going to get slagged off in the comment thread of Mumbrella if we do so. So for the message on the billboard, they eventually put was, we knew whatever we put here would get slagged off on the comment thread of Mumbrella. So we got a framed shot of that, and we put it up in reception at the Mumbrella office.
That is gold.
One day, somebody sneaked into our office and stole it.
Are you kidding?
So I no longer have the picture. They literally came in through the front door, snatched it and ran away. And to this day, we always thought, oh, it was probably a prank. It will turn up. Never did.
Wow. It must have been like someone who either worked at Mumbrella or potentially worked at Mediacom.
Yeah, well, Mediacom were the ones who sent us the picture in the first place. So I think they would have had their own print of it. But yes, it was either that or given that we were in Chippendale, which was certainly in the early days of Mumbrella a bit rougher and less genteel than it is now, then maybe it was just a passing vagrant. But
yes. If you were to have it, then if you were to have your own space on Broadway on that billboard, what would you put on it?
I think I would channel David Ogilvy, ban all billboards.
I like that. That's good. It's very good. I'm going to do an ad for that. Ban all billboards. Just push it on Facebook. Look, Tim, this has been great. I'm so glad we could do this. And thanks for rearranging and sticking on with us for...
Well, more to point out, no, I think it's me who should be thanking you because you very kindly not made the point. I did entirely forget about our appointment. So we're doing it 90 minutes later than planned. So thank you for your flexibility.
Now, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Oh, gosh. Still mostly on Mumbrella. So I'm even though I'm on long service leave, I'm still working Fridays to write the best of the week email. So you'll still be able to find that free to subscribe. So please do sign up. Otherwise, hey, I guess I'm probably most active on LinkedIn of the various social networks, to be honest. Right. So feel free to hook up there.
LinkedIn, we'll reference that. We'll link everything in the show notes as well for people who are listening. Jacob, young Jacob, our producer, cool, will link the blog post as well. But
And by all means, you never know, I might do some more stuff on Substack. So do sign up for Fifth Day, which is my Substack thing as well. But don't expect to see anything more until January or February on that, though.
Yeah, at least 61 days from now. Don't expect
absolutely
to see
anything. But yes, but my most recent post was on a reassessment of Ogilvy on advertising. So, hey.
Tim, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening in to this episode. If you like it, do leave us a written review on your podcast app as it helps us continue going on a weekly basis. And we do love reading those reviews as well. If you want the show notes, you can find that below or with our previous guest at neural.com/podcast. That's neural.com/podcast. To watch the full video, search Uncommon Show on YouTube, and to keep up to date with behind the scenes and clips for the show, you can find us at Uncommon_show on Instagram. But until next time, guys, thank you so much for listening.